to call a meeting to order. And today we do have with us not just the Environment Policy and Oversight Committee, but we also have the Transportation Finance and Transportation Policy Committee. So we have the chairs with us today of those two committees, Representative Leader and Representative Hornstein. And we welcome the chairs and their committees here today. I think it'll be an interesting hearing. We're going to be dealing today with some of the NCAG reports dealing with land use, transportation and land use policy, dealing with the low carbon fuel standards. We are not going to be dealing with the clean car issue today. We are going to be holding a hearing on that in a following committee, actually next week. So today we want to focus on those two issues. And we do have with us several testifiers. Starting off, we're going to hear from William Shore, who's with Smart Growth America, formerly from the Center of Climate Strategies, and he's the one who convened the TWIG group, the Technical Working Group on Transportation and Land Use Policy. And thank you for joining us today, Mr. Shore, and if you could state your name for the record, please, and begin your presentation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Eakin, and ladies and gentlemen of the committee, thank you for having us all here today. My name is Will Schroer, S-C-H-R-O-E-E-R. We were invited here today to talk with you about the recommendations that emerged from the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group process, commissioned by Governor Pawlenty and carried out in part by the folks that you have in front of you today. So the way that we would like to proceed is as follows. As stated, I was the facilitator for the transportation and land use group that was part of the Governor's Smith, and I will explain what that meant. And then we will go through each of the transportation and land use recommendations, not in too much detail given the time that we have, but we'll go through them one by one. We have what we like to think of as a representative sample of the folks on the technical working group here for you today. And the way we'd like to proceed is so much as we proceeded on the technical working group, which was collegially and with a lot of back and forth. We have not rehearsed for you since, you know, handoff. We have agreed beforehand, and I'll ask my colleagues again to jump in as they see fit. My role here, it will be as it was to facilitate a little bit the discussion. So with that introduction, let me draw your attention to, and we have some slides, but they're not going to be absolutely crucial, I don't think. I recommend to you a little light reading, the final recommendations and final report from the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group. It's on the web. We brought a couple of copies with us, but we frankly didn't know how many we should bring, so we just brought five. So, and draw whatever decision. But it is on the web. It's easy to find. Just Google for the title, and it'll pop up. The genesis of that process was the passage of the Next Generation Energy Initiative passed by you and your colleagues in 2007 and signed. And that legislation requires reductions in greenhouse gas emissions of 15% from that baseline by 2015, 30% by 2025, and 80% by 2050. And those reduction targets are driven by what the science tells us we need to do in order to avoid even worse impacts on our climate than we're probably looking at already. Our goal here today is not to get into those scenarios, but to tell you how we think that Minnesota can contribute to and can achieve these reductions, which we have to have if we want to preserve our quality of life in the state. The last thing I'll say about this is a couple of us worked a little bit on this overview together, and the original draft that said this Next Generation Energy Initiative requires reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, and I changed that to requires because it is a current requirement. It's an ongoing requirement that we are here in part today to help fulfill. A few words about the process that produced the recommendations in the report that is in front of you. It was a stakeholder process convened by and given its charge by the governor. The governor personally, or with the support of his commissioners, selected the stakeholders to represent elected, local elected, state elected, government staff, citizens, and businesses from around the state. And I can tell you they really were from around the state. We had a lot of people coming in from out of state and occasionally plus travel horror stories. The process was facilitated, not driven, which means that the governor gave the process a charge. How shall the state achieve reduction of greenhouse gas emissions that are required by the Next Generation Energy Initiative? So it was not a sort of consultant process where the consultant goes away and comes back with an answer a year later. It was a stakeholder process facilitated by the Center for Climate Strategies, a nonprofit organization that does the fifth. And I was the facilitator for one of the technical working groups. There were working groups for each of the major sectors of Minnesota's economy, transportation and land use, energy supply, or in layman's terms, power plants, energy use, buildings, factories, etc., agriculture, forestry, and waste. And waste got in there because ag and forestry produce a lot of byproducts that are really waste that they can be used to generate energy. And then we had a cross-cutting sector which looked at actions that potentially affect all sectors, like the cap and trade program or the awareness-raising efforts, etc. Am I forgetting one of the sectors? Okay, good. I want to emphasize that because it was a stakeholder-driven process and not just a bunch of experts sequestered for a year, that it was a learning process for all of us. And I would like to emphasize that particularly in the TL Transportation and Land Use Working Group, there was a particular amount of learning going on. My colleagues who ran some of the other sectors, I felt a little bit jealous of sometimes because the energy supply folks had apparently been working together for the last 10 or 20 years and knew each other and knew the situation with power plants in Minnesota and knew the lingo and knew what the technical challenges were. And that doesn't mean they agreed necessarily, and this was a different problem than they had worked on together before, but everyone sort of belonged to the same, if you will, power plant community. And in transportation and land use, that was not the case. You had energy, you had vehicle technology folks working on higher MPG and more efficient vehicles. They had a lot to teach the rest of us. You had fuel folks that worked on biofuels and how to reduce the carbon content of fossil fuels, et cetera. And they had a lot to teach us, and often they knew the vehicle technology guys. And then there were the land use folks who are working on reducing the distance that everybody has to travel between home and work and play so that whatever you're driving, whatever fuel you're using, those distances are shorter and produce less emissions. And those knew some of the other folks. But generally speaking, this was not a group that had sort of convened and talked to each other in a focused way for a long, over a sustained period in most cases. So there was a lot of learning that went on in our group, and I really think it was a fantastic. I learned a lot, and I don't mean to speak for my colleagues, but maybe they can say that they learned a lot too. Good. And then finally, the governor's charge to the MCAG was not to produce. It was to produce recommendations. It was not necessarily to produce unanimous recommendations. All else being equal, of course, unanimous recommendation is easier to act on than one that's not. So the governor was eager for unanimous, but if we couldn't produce them, then at least be transparent about whether the recommendations were unanimous. What we ended up calling supermajority, which was almost unanimous with some objections, or just a simple majority, and we had some of those too. Let me stop and ask, because I really do think that the process was a very important part of what we finally produced, and I want to stop here and ask if folks have any questions about the process, or if my colleagues would like to say anything.
Representative Erdahl has a question.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Lampert, or anyone that. Can you describe the voting process of the MCAG?
Certainly. So we had the five technical work groups, one for each of the sectors, and stakeholders that were particularly interested or had specific expertise in those work groups, started with a set of recommendations or policy options which had been floated in other places, added their own Minnesota-specific or tweaked those options from other places, went through a round of, we like those, we don't like those, eventually came to a refined set of options. That was a very short story for a process that took a year, obviously, we're able to leave the technical work group and go to the overall group, which was the collection of stakeholders from all the technical work groups. And at each step of the process, the technical work group had no formal authority on its own. Only the overall stakeholder group, all the folks, which were like 60 people in the end, could make formal decisions about what policies advanced or did not advance. So our first job was to come up with the universe of policies that we were going to look at. We took those to the group of 60, and the group of 60 gave the thumbs up or thumbs down. Not that these are good or bad policies, but we agree that these are policies that can be looked at.
I'm Jane Callison, the agenda says Hennepin County. I was the mayor of Minnetonka at the time, so Hennepin County may not want to accept what I'm saying at this point. But my memory was that early on in the TLU, the work group, we did have up and down votes on which policies went forward, and that was not a consensus process as much. That really was majority ruled on some of those items. So.
Yeah, we had to come up with our own rules a little bit in the twig, but it was also the case that in the end it was formal, as far as the governor's commission was concerned, it was the formal responsibility of the total group to either move forward on or not move forward on a specific policy. And so if we voted something down, they could put it back in and say, no, you are going to look at that. And did that happen once? I think that might have happened once. Cleveland, that's right.
But I think there were also some of the policy decisions that the group decided not to consider and they did not.
And so when you make reference then to something passing unanimously or by a supermajority or majority, you're talking about the whole group then, not just the twig.
Thank you for clarifying that for me, and you're absolutely right about that. That's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Schroer.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, yes,
Mr. Lambert, state your name for the record, please.
I'm Scott Lambert with the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. And I think Will is right, and I'm going to just depart just a bit. Within our working group, I think we all work pretty collegially, and we all came trying to do our best efforts. But I think overall, the process was maybe not staff-driven, but it was maybe steered a bit. I'd use that word instead by the Center for Climate Strategies. It was a process that they're very adept at. And if you look at other reports from other states, they're all remarkably similar. They all got kind of the same ideas, just different numbers plugged in. It was late in the process. It was hard to get an idea out of the big group. My example is when you look at the Fit to First transportation investment policy, we sort of wanted to abandon that about three quarters of the way through. We couldn't quantify it. We didn't know why it was even in there. No one could explain it very well. But it was hard to get it out. And I think one of the problems in the full MCAG, the objection I had with the way they voted was that they never really called for the yeas and nays. The group never voted. You had to object. Everything was in, and you had to object to get it out. And in many cases, the way they objected was you'd have to stand up. So the chair would say, who objects to this, stand up. And that may not sound like a big deal, and certainly for those of you who are in elected office and for some of us who've been around for a while in the process, that's maybe not very intimidating, but for a citizen who's on the panel, it can be a very intimidating thing. And I think it was a kind of a deft way that they kept things in the process and kept things within the control of the final report. The other problem we had, frankly, was that the schedule was so worrying. I don't remember how long this lasted, but in terms of the big group, our working group stuck with it. But in terms of the big group, business representatives, especially those who had to travel a distance, we just kind of wore them out, and they stopped coming. And by the time we were pretty well down the road. There are people we haven't seen in three or four meetings, and it's too bad. It's too, we just, you know, by the end of the process, it was a lot of professional advocates, and it was meant to be more of a citizen process. And I think we just wore people down, and I think that affected the final outcome. But I will agree that our group worked well. We had lots of disagreements, and we were all very collegial about it, which I think we were. And I agree. We all learned quite a bit in this process, and it was a good exercise for a lot of us who are still involved in a lot of these issues.
Okay. One thing that might be helpful, you were talking about people being worn down, a number of people not showing up sometimes to the meetings, is the number of people who were present when votes were taking place. Anyway, I don't know if there was if you'd want to state your name for the record, please. And then we should probably move on and take testimony from each one.
Yes, Mr. Chair, my name for the record is Mark Vanderschaft. I'm the planning director at the Metropolitan Council. And just as a clarification, the Metropolitan Council was not technically represented on the work group. We monitored the work group, so we were not part of the voting.
Okay. Thank you for joining us. And Representative Holberg.
Well, Mr. Chair, I didn't hear a response to your concern, but I would be interested in knowing if, and they've taken the report away, I think, to make copies, but you have certain numbers, so I'm just trying to get a clear understanding of how the report came to be as far as what was in and out, but were the number of dissensions then put up against the total number of people on the working group or committee, or was it those in attendance? So how did that shake out?
Sure. I think just as well for thank you. We'll give you the objections when we get to the individual recommendations. Will that be useful to have them connected with those?
Well, again, what I'm trying to find out is were the number of when you say it was a majority.
Oh, I understand.
Were you running those numbers against those in the room, those actually voting, or against the totality of the group of which we're hearing some kind of gave up at the end?
That's a good question.
For sure.
Thank you. I believe that it was those voting.
They took a role of who was there at the start of every meeting. Proxies were not allowed, so if somebody didn't come, that was too bad. And they based the votes based on who was in the room at the time. But then they had levels of support. It was unanimous, supermajority, majority, or out.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. If I might then, so the majority of this report, was it put together at the final meeting with everybody voting? So would there be one roster that would be able to review to find out who participated in the decision making?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Lambert,
sorry, Jim. These were not recorded votes. So I believe most of the decisions were made in the last two meetings, but they weren't recorded. People stood up or didn't stand if they objected to something.
Right.
Although there would be.
I understand that, but I guess what my question is that I would like to know if 80% of the people voting on this were working for think tanks or do-gooder organizations or, you know, whatever, to try and get a flavor for how the group looked at the time these decisions were making. Did we have a fair balance representing all elements of our community, or was it by the end, as some have suggested, very tilted to those most dedicated to a particular outcome?
Mr. Schwartz.
Thank you very much. Representative Holberg, the complete set of stakeholders is in the report, and the attendance at the final meetings is not, but would be easy to get. We certainly kept those records. So if that would be helpful to you, you can talk to me and I can try and get those for you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, and it's Ms. Callison.
I don't want to leave the impression that I entirely agree with Scott's characterization of the end of the meeting. That'd be unfair to all of us who sat through a whole year of this. Certainly there were a lot of meetings, more meetings than we expected. I thought attendance was really very good. It continued to be a well-balanced group. Business was well represented, as were interest groups. I think I was the only elected representative there. But at the end, I think we had 90% attendance, I guess. I mean, pretty pretty high, so it was a long process. I certainly wouldn't disagree about that, but I think people stuck with it because they thought it was important.
Okay, and as far as when the votes took place, I would guess that the votes there were meetings where there weren't votes taking place as well, which was mainly informational. Maybe that's where the attendance maybe wasn't as great. I would think that the attendance during the times when you were actually voting would have been pretty high.
And I think there was some relaxation of the rule on proxy so that people were able to designate ahead of time and get substitutes there. So I think that the process worked that way as well to make sure there was maximum participation.
Okay. And go ahead.
Mr. Chair, my name is Barb Solomon, and I served on the advisory committee as well. And of the 11 recommendations that we will describe to you today, that were put forward by the TWIG and then were adopted by the full working group, there were only two that did not pass by a supermajority. Many of them passed unanimously, and as we go through them today, we can describe to you which ones were more controversial, and you'll probably, when you hear us describe them, understand why that was. But I think the last meeting, there were about 36 people in attendance, and we had one of the recommendations had 16 in opposition, and so it passed with only a majority as opposed to a supermajority. But there were only two like that out of 11.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Solomon. And Representative Hortman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just would want to echo that I don't think Mr. Lambert's view of the staff-driven nature of the process would be the majority view of the participants in the process. I was one of the people who listened in on all the telephone calls for the Transportation and Land Use Working Group and went to the MCAG meetings in person, and they were always standing room only. It's also noteworthy that the governor did appoint every single member of the entire MCAG and the working group. And so if you want to do a black hat, green hat count, the black hats and the green hats were both well represented. But as compared to other states' processes, this is the only state where the governor appointed everybody. So with respect to the idea that perhaps this was just a do-gooder activist group cooking up some recommendations, this is the governor's handpicked group.
Okay. I think that's a good point, Representative Hortman. And I think what we'll do, I want to make sure that we do get through all the testifiers. So I think we'll go through each testifier first, and if members have questions they really want to ask that are pertinent to the specific point being made, feel free to do so. But if you could hold until the end, that would be helpful, I think. So until the end of each testifier. So if we could continue on, and Mr. Troy, you have...
Thank you very much. I'm going to tee up the rest of my colleagues here, and I appreciate your helping move us along. I also thought the discussion about the process of this, it was important because that really was the foundation for our recommendations. Transportation and land use has its own had its own sector because it's a quarter of the emissions from Minnesota, and that's more than enough to take a good whack at. The MCAG then, with respect to that sector, came out with recommendations in three broad areas in transportation and land use. Reduce, and if you're new to this, carbon is sort of the shorthand for greenhouse gas warming unit. It's really the carbon in most of the emissions that is the problem, so this is just the shorthand. Reduce carbon per unit of fuel, so if you're talking about a low-carbon fuel, you have the same amount of fuel that produces less of the worrisome pollutants. Number two, you can make the engine more efficient so that it burns less of the fuel and therefore produces less carbon per mile, or if you're doing something that's not traveling per hour, like a generator at a building site. The third thing that one can do is to reduce the total amount of activity, so running the generator at the building site less often or driving less miles. I won't belabor this point, but I throw it out there as context for the rest of the discussion. At the risk of overgeneralizing, I think that the TWIG thought first that it would be better to take a harder look at the first two sets of these recommendations. That it would be easier, again, to use a broad word, to reduce emissions either through lowering the carbon in the fuel or by making engines more efficient. And as you'll see, that turned out not to be enough to make our goals, and so the Twig looked then at reducing vehicle miles traveled. It looks like the reports are coming around, and thank you very much for staff who are always put on the spot in these kind of situations. I will not ask you to walk through this on the screens or even on the paper in front of you in detail, mostly because you don't have time, but I will suggest that you take a look at it later and draw a couple of things to your attention. The first is that we ended up, as you see, grouping our recommendations into the three areas that I just went over. Less carbon per unit of fuel, less carbon per mile, and reducing miles. And as Barb Thoman just mentioned, most of these passed the overall MCAG stakeholder group with unanimous recommendations. Almost all of them passed with either unanimous or super majority, and we had two that passed only by a majority, one of which we're not going to talk about here today, which is the California Clean Car. I would also draw your attention to the fact that in the MCAG judgment, and so the MCAG reviewed not only our recommendations, but also all the analysis behind those recommendations, in the analysis that they adopted, agreed that all of these were net savings generators for the state as a whole over the time period we're looking at. Now, that doesn't mean that they're free. That doesn't mean that they don't cost money to implement. It means that over the course of the implementation, there are net savings to Minnesota and its citizens over the course of the implementation. That's all I'll say about that table unless my colleagues are interested. Very good. Let me now, and even though VMT comes at the top on this table, I want to put that off until the end so that we, if we have time, we can spend more time discussing it. Who would like to take, and I told you we didn't tee this up, for better or for worse, so who would like to discuss low carbon fuel standards? Anyone? Well, I think that I'll dispense with it quickly, again, because as I understand it, it's not the main interest of this committee. California has adopted a low carbon fuel standard, which is requiring that the end use of fuels in that state reduce carbon content by 10%, 15%. I haven't memorized it anyway. And they are developing regulations for where that responsibility lies. Does it lie with the distributors? Does it rely with the end retailer? Whose responsibility is it to monitor the carbon content of the fuel, et cetera? And our recommendation to the MCAG, which the MCAG adopted, was develop a similar set of regulations that would reduce the end content of carbon in fuel burned in Minnesota overall, not that each gallon has to go down by 20%, but that on average it falls by 20% by 2025. That would save 3.6 million metric tons of carbon, which in plainer English is about 35% of what the state needs to get out of transportation and land use. 10% of our economy. So then we moved on. And there was a lot of debate about that, and again, I'm not going to dwell on this, but, you know, can we get that 10% out of fuels? Biofuels help us. What's the role of ethanol in that? A lot of debate, and I think that would be the subject for another very interesting hearing if you care to have one. Then we talked about making engines and operations generally more efficient. TLU-6 adopts California Clean Car Standards. A little bit of debate, honestly, about the name. Maybe we should call them clean car standards because, after all, they'd be in Minnesota and we're not placed in California. In the end, I think it's just honest to say we would be adopting California clean car standards and they accept them and we would be adopting them. But they would become, obviously, Minnesota clean car standards if they were adopted. So that's the vast majority of these reductions. TLU-12 is voluntary emissions from reductions from fleets. That's, you know, commercial trucking operations and things like that. Reducing maximum speed limits actually has a potentially high impact on the efficiency of the operations of the vehicle. And so that was moved forward with, as you see, only a majority of MCAG members liking that one, but I have to tell you it's the second largest hit. And then FOU 4 is just running our roads more efficiently through more efficient stoplights. MnDOT, I think, does a great job with incident management, pulling things off the highways and across traffic jams, just making everybody run more efficiently, and that gets you some benefits. Altogether, those are 20% of the reductions that we needed. So just some basic math here. So if you have 35% coming out of low-carbon fuel and 20% coming out of more efficient engines and operations, you're at 55% of what you needed to get to. And so then with, I think, reluctance on the part of some of the members and enthusiasm on the part of some of the others, because they think that these are good for other reasons other than just greenhouse gases, we turned to reducing vehicle miles traveled. And so here I'm gonna now put my colleagues to work and ask them to speak with you about some of the considerations that we had here. Are you raising your hand? Or? Okay.
So thank you, Mr. Shore. And actually, in regard to the low carbon fuel standard, that is one of the things that we did want to talk about today.
Okay.
Just the clean cars that we're going to be leaving until next week. So that and the land use issues.
Okay.
And who would like to testify next?
Mark, do you want to say a word about VMC trends?
Okay, so Ms. Spillman.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we had a lot of conversations in the group about vehicle miles traveled and where they're going in terms of miles per household and miles per individual, and then also what kind of trend, what we need to see to reduce enough of the driving so that we get an appreciable reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. During the process, we heard from the Minnesota Department of Transportation and the Met Council that we've been driving less, and that the trend that we have seen for nearly 20 years of vehicle miles traveled per person increasing at a rate of about 2.2% had really flattened out, and that began in about 2005. We saw almost no increase in 2005, 6, 7, and then we actually saw a decline in vehicle miles traveled in 2008. So because of that, the DOT came to us and said, we're going to adjust some of our estimates for this process to take account of that reduction in driving that we're seeing, that we actually don't think that it's an aberration anymore. We think it's really a trend. And so those new numbers for VMC growth did factor into the emissions reductions that we then estimated or projected from the strategies that we're talking about. So MnDOT and the Met Council's new estimates of the growth in VMP is half of what it was just a few years ago. It's down 2.9% a year. And our organization put out a report last year on transportation performance measurement, and in there we took information from the Federal Highway Administration's website looking at VMP in, and this is urban regions across the country, to sort of see how do we stack up in terms of how much we drive here as compared to how much people drive in some of our peer regions. And what we found is that we drive more than average here in the Twin Cities region, and that some places do drive more, Atlanta being one of those, St. Louis being another, but that in some of our regions, peer regions, they drive significantly less. Portland, Oregon, the average household or the average individual in that city drives 2,000 miles a year less than people who live here in Seattle, 1,000 miles a year less, and I could give you some other ideas, but just to get back to the strategy. So maybe we just I don't know if someone else wants to talk about what makes it going. Keep going? All right, I'll carry on. So we came up within the TWIG, we talked about it for a long time, we talked about these various strategies, and then we voted out a number of strategies that would be under this umbrella of reducing vehicle miles traveled. And you'd reduce vehicle miles traveled not by saying you must leave your car in the garage, but typically by providing people with alternatives to driving, either for some trips to shopping, trips to school, trips to work, And those trips can become trips that are not just drive-alone trips anymore, but trips with somebody else in a carpool, a van pool, trips that you take as a chain trip. My parents were telling me that when gas prices went up, they changed their driving patterns. Instead of going out sort of recreationally every day to drive to the Home Depot and to the Walmart, they decided that they would actually do those kind of errands on one day, on Wednesday. And then they would drive and do all of their errands kind of in a row. So you can reduce VMT just by paying your trips together. You can also reduce them by increasing the amount that you walk, you bicycle, or you take public transportation. So one of the strategies that we that was adopted, and I believe, was this one adopted again? Was expanding transit, bicycle, and pedestrian infrastructure across the state. And we looked at the Met Council's plan calls for doubling transit ridership by 2030. At one time, they had a goal of doubling transit ridership by 2020. And we said within the TWIG, we talked about that, and we said if we're going to really be serious about meeting these goals, we're going to have to implement this transit plan more quickly. And so we recommended that they go back to their previous plan, which was to build out the bus and rail system in the Twin Cities region by 2020 as opposed to 2030. There was also a recommendation related to improving transit within cities and counties in greater Minnesota and also providing better connections between cities in greater Minnesota and the Twin Cities, and even things like publicizing those services. An anecdotal sort of an example would be there's a van that runs hourly from the city of Rochester into the Twin Cities. It drops you off at the Minneapolis airport. From there, you can take the light rail or a bus to other locations. I have many friends who live in Rochester, and none of them know about this van. So promoting that kind of service. I lived for a number of years in the city of Winona, and I remember many times getting in my car to come to a meeting in the Twin Cities and looking out my window and seeing my county commissioner or one of the people who worked at Mateka Recycling, and we were all driving to the city for a meeting, or we were all driving to the city that day to visit family. But none of us knew that the others were going. So again, just coming up with ways that we can improve these connections between the Twin Cities and greater Minnesota, and then transit within all of these regions. I'm thinking this might be a good one to talk about. Another strategy was implementing climate-friendly transportation pricing.
Sure. As we all saw over the past year or so, people respond to price signals. They arrive at the gas pump or other ways. And this was a way for the TWIG to advance to the broader group the notion that the way that we pay for transportation generally it's not set up right now to reward the kind of choices that that making these climate goals is going to require. So this was not about a gas tax or about tolling necessarily. It was about taking a hard look at all of the options that that the state might need to look at, both to meet climate goals and to meet some of these other goals. And as sort of a wonk in this area, I was watching with interest the exchange between new Transportation Secretary LaHood and the White House, who ostensibly are on the same team. 2 days ago, the Transportation Secretary said, you know, we really have to look at a per-mile fee in order to pay for our transportation system going forward. And the next day, Press Secretary Gibbs was asked about that, and he said, forget about it, it's not going to happen. So even within the same administration, I think there's different views on the efficacy of this, but there is agreement that we have to look at something else, because the gas tax is not paying for, it's not producing enough money to produce the transportation system that we need. Almost everybody agrees on that. And so this was the TWIG's way of saying to the MCAG, when the we're not recommending, you know, X, Y, or Z policy, because that is a little bit beyond our charge here with respect to transportation pricing. What we are saying to the governor and to the legislature is, when you do solve the transportation funding problem, you must solve it in a way that takes into account the effect on emissions, or you're never going to make your climate goals, because people do respond to price signals. And so the examples that were included in this recommendation are largely to break costs out so that people can respond to them individually. And so a good example is pay-as-you-drive insurance. If Winona Barb carpools to the city with her fellow commissioner, the insurance company is that much less exposed. Barb's car is safely at home and not getting an accident, but she doesn't pay any less for making that decision. And a number of states around the country allow insurance companies to offer by-the-mile insurance, and some states are looking at a more aggressive implementation than just allowing it. And so that's an example of the kind of thing where we the MCAG thought that Minnesota needed to move aggressively in that direction, and that the benefits would include not only fewer emissions, but people could save money at the same time if they chose to behave differently. Any additional comments on CLU 5?
Well, if I could.
Certainly.
Mr. Chairman, I think I was one of the thorns in this particular TLU, and the group did their best to accommodate my concerns. Climate-friendly transportation pricing sounds happy and friendly, and if we're talking about incentives, you're talking about trying to change people's behavior. And if you're talking about incentives, you know, I didn't object to that, but oftentimes there's sort of a dark side to this particular policy, and we're talking about taxing people out of vehicles and taxing them out of what for many of them are necessities. Not everybody drives because they want to. People, you know, drive different vehicles and different sizes of vehicles often because they have to. And I objected to that side of this. And as it started out, there was a lot more of the kind of punitive taxing elements involved. And I think my colleagues on Twig listened to me and softened this as best they could. But I think that element is still in this, and it's still a concern for us. So I was one of the objections to this.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Lambert. And Mr. Shore?
Thank you very much. TLU 7, a fix-the-first transportation policy. The core idea here is that if the goal is to reduce vehicle miles traveled and to reduce the distance that one has to travel between home, work, play, etc., one of the ways to do that is to make it easier to travel within currently developed areas. Fix the infrastructure that we have first before you build roads out to places where people are not, and move those destinations further apart. So that's sub-policy number one. Sub-policy number two is to retrofit existing roads, and here we need to fix it not only and fill the pothole, but make the road serve more people where it currently is. And we have a nice photo here of a retrofit. This is not a new road or a fixed road. It's a retrofitted road so that it serves drivers, pedestrians, nice wide sidewalk here, and transit users all at the same time. And part and parcel of that is then less focus on road expansion, which saves money and also as a byproduct reduces BMP. CLU 9, workplace tools to encourage and I would say to support carpooling, bicycling, and transit. The number one most powerful determinant of how someone gets to work is actually not the choices that they have in front of their doorway. Obviously, that makes a difference. It's how their employer feels about those choices. Two employers, and you can think of people who work, you know, in downtown or maybe in the downtown near where you work, next to the Twin Cities downtown. One of them buys the transit pass for the employees and says, this is an important thing and it matters to us. And the other one is like, we're renting your garage for you. that makes a big difference, right, between how those two employees who are in exactly the same place have exactly the same access to amenities and probably are drawn from the same, you know, employment shed get to work. And so we specifically called out the focus on employers as a good place to work on making it easier for people to get to work without driving their own car. Once again, saves people money, saves on municipal parking garage costs, saves on private parking garage costs, and almost entirely successful in those Minnesota employees that use it. And really, it's just a matter of funding to get more serious about this and expand it. So that was unanimous. I'll speak frankly and say I was a little disappointed in our ability to say more about freight. Freight produces an enormous chunk of Minnesota transportation emissions today, and it's growing. Even as we drive less, there are more trucks, more trains. Not that that's necessarily a bad thing. We're not here to judge it one way or the other. It's just a fact, and that if you want to get a handle on greenhouse gas emissions, you kind of have to look at the freight sector, too. Because it's such a different animal, we were not within, even though we went for quite a while, we were not in the end able to get a good handle on recommendations in the freight sector. So basically what we said is we encouraged the governor to tell DOT to do a good study of rail throughout Minnesota, both within and without, and to further work with intermodal public-private partnerships. If you've ever seen the intermodal yards, either in Northtown, in North Minneapolis, or in Midway in St. Paul, where trucks drop off their trailers, which are then loaded onto trains and taken to Chicago or Seattle or St. Louis. You know, it's really an impressive sight. The driver gets to stay home and feed the kids, and you don't have to drive the extra cab all the way to Chicago. Only the trailer really needs to go to send the trailer. There is some work that the government can do to facilitate those kind of partnerships. It's mostly a private thing. So, again, a direction to DOT to see if there's anything else we can do in that area. And then the big dog was TLU-1, improved land use planning and development strategies. And I'm just going to pull out a couple of high points here and then ask Jan to go through a couple of these. So get ready, Jan. First of all, we distinguished between the metropolitan area and greater Minnesota, and that's common sense. And within the greater metropolitan area, we advanced what I think by the end of the process seems to be the common sense notion of if you want to reduce people's need to drive between places, you have to put more of those places closer to each other, and so we recommended absorbing more growth in the existing developed urban area. We set some actual numerical goals for those absorbing that growth that we had some confidence in. We had less confidence in, we had the same confidence in that it was a good idea for outstate, but didn't have the same confidence in developing a number, so we didn't develop a number for outstate. I would draw to your attention the conclusion that we need to start doing this right away because if we're going to make these goals by 2025, we don't have time to mess around in plain English. And then there were a set of recommendations that applied both to the Twin Cities and to Greater Minnesota. And with that brief introduction, I'm going to ask former Mayor Callison to talk about what the sub-recommendations within that overall recommendation are.
Commissioner Callison.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm going to start out with a few general comments, if I may, because I understand part of what you're looking for is a more in-depth understanding of what came out of the process and an understanding of these various recommendations. So let me tell you my take on the process, which was to understand that it was a first step in what's going to be a long dialogue. And at some point it became a math problem as well. So there were some numerical goals that had been established that we had to try and meet. And we had to rely upon the center to do the calculations. We had to accept those numbers and sort of plug them in and see, were we going to get to, you know, a 20% reduction if we did this, or we're not? Okay, we need to add this strategy. So it really was a math problem. There's a lot of assumptions in those numbers, and you should be aware of those assumptions and really take them as guides.
but there's a lot of work that has to be done by you and others to work through this. One of my biases as a local elected official, whether that's mayor or now Hennepin County Commissioner, is that the legislature not micromanage. And I think this is an area in particular where it's easy to micromanage, where you say, here's what you have to do, rather than say, here's the result that we want. And so that was one of my themes, I think, was to try and not have this be so prescriptive that you didn't get good policy because all the choices were taken away. There were a couple of items in particular, I think, where we differed as a group. One of those was the reducing the speed limit, where we really had a difference of opinion about that. We had a difference of opinion about transportation pricing, and that was one where I thought the dialogue was particularly rich because there was an opportunity to both find a new way to fund, to tax, if you will, and to use that money to solve some of the issues and to begin to address the climate change. So the idea behind a vehicle miles tax, or a VMT, was that you change the way you raise funds for these projects, and you can really accomplish two things at once. You can stabilize that revenue source as well as provide revenue for some of these solutions. So that was one we had a lot of conversation about, and Scott is correct in terms of how he portrayed some of the discussion, but I thought it was really a helpful discussion as we went forward. And we looked at some of these, I think as we went through, trying to find places where there would be big bang for the buck. One of those was vehicle idling. We talked about whether you could make some retrofits, especially for freight. So if they're parked overnight, rather than having the motors running, they can plug in to an electric system and you can make some reductions. So we tried to look both for some places where a small investment would produce big results, as well as places where you really had to do big things because of the problem. And that's probably one of the areas where we began to talk about the land use. So these probably are not going to be surprises to any of you. One was more growth in the developed areas in the metro and greater Minnesota. And the whole idea, of course, is that you can get people clustered into whether there are the amenities and the jobs, you can reduce the mileage, the miles that they're traveling, and you can have an impact. Is that one? Mark, go ahead.
In the issue of reducing vehicle miles traveled.
Excuse me, if you state your name again.
Yes, Mark Vanderschaft from Metropolitan Council. Just wanting to highlight Met Council's position on the issue of more growth in developed areas. In Minnesota, there's the Metropolitan Land Planning Act, which sets up a 10-year planning cycle involving the Metropolitan Council and local communities. That cycle is just coming to an end, the current cycle, with approval of plans for local communities through the year 2030. And it is based on a forecast and an expectation that approximately 30% of the housing between the year 2000 and 2030 would be in developed communities. And the recommendation of the of MCAG was to double that percentage. The council continues to stand by its original forecast at this time. It is the basis for the plans that are coming to completion at this point. And we're the trends that we're seeing, we think, still support that that pattern, basically. So that was an area where we did have some disagreement. I think, though, to put it in a positive light, we believe that there are certainly ways that in developing areas as well, developing fringe suburbs, that this overall goal of bringing people closer together with where they work and with where they shop, that this can be done. And in fact, a lot of the job growth in the developing areas that has occurred recently is bringing the jobs closer to where people live. So we feel that those strategies and tactics can be pursued, but we don't see that 60% of the housing growth and 75% of the job growth would feasibly occur within the developed areas.
Okay. Mr. Vanderschaft, and Representative Erdahl has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and kind of raise a point where you're talking about you know, the vehicle mileage tax. Now, I represent a lot of people who commute in from Meeker County and Wright County.
And why I question a little bit the fairness of this, and you know, would hope that someone would look at a different way to do it. You know, I have people who drive in and take them an hour. And there might be people in traffic sitting in their cars for 1 hour. But, you know, the people that come in from my area are going to be paying a higher tax because, you know, you might be traveling a shorter distance, but you're staying in the car at the same time. So, that's one point. And another, you talk about transit to greater Minnesota, the population areas. Could you give me a few examples of where you're thinking of those transit corridors, what you've been talking about?
Mr. Chair and members, we listed, I don't think we did, we certainly didn't do any kind of exhaustive analysis of what kind of, what the service could look like. It's just that we thought that as part of a strategy looking at improving public transit within the state of Minnesota, that we needed not only better transit within the metropolitan area, but also better connections between cities, especially regional centers in greater Minnesota, and the Twin Cities, and then certainly improve transit within the regional centers that are out there, and transit in those counties that have none whatsoever today. So the Minnesota Department of Transportation's Office of Transit is doing another transit study, so they'll be looking at what the needs are out there, but they're also limited in their ability to envision the future by limited resources. And so, you know, in this analysis that we did not say, well, we have to do it within existing resources. Some of the things that we recommend do cost money. I mean, they will cost the government money. To double the public transit system, to double ridership in the Twin Cities region 10 years early can't be done with the new quarter cent regional sales tax. It would require another quarter cent. But since our charge was to figure out what are we going to have to do to try to meet these greenhouse gas emission goals, we had to go beyond what is out there today to be able to do that. And our analysis was that since transportation is 25% of the greenhouse gas emissions, we should come up with strategies that would take care of about 25% of the greenhouse gas emissions.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Thoman. Representative Rudolph.
Thank you, and you know, I appreciate that. And particularly appreciate the fact that you talked about going to the regional centers, because normally we hear about going to Duluth, going to Rochester, but just west of me there's a regional center called Wilmer that generally is ignored in this. That whole section of Minnesota generally is ignored in this. And since I have kind of a different audience, if you will, today, let me just say the word Little Crow Line. We have a corridor that was named out there, and we want that looked at.
Okay. Commissioner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the learning items for me anyway was understanding how much greater Minnesota contributes to greenhouse gases. That we think of this as a metro problem. It really, there's a substantial contribution from greater Minnesota, and that feeds into what you're saying. For the VMT tax, the idea behind it is that people should understand the costs and the implications of the choices they make. And there are certainly policy decisions to be made. There are some areas that I think are piloting that, so people are working on it. But it also gives people some information about the decisions they make and the consequences of the decisions they make, and that was one of the reasons I think that it was attractive to us. Should I go on with these other?
Yes, please continue. And we will, just a reminder, we did send out an email as well that the committee meeting, we plan to go until 6:30 to finish up with the transportation studies report as well. But if we could finish up definitely by 6 o'clock, that would be great. So, thank you. With your report, and then we'll move on to the next. Thank you. Sure, Representative Rudolph.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make sure that the greenhouse emissions, we're not talking about cows today.
That would be another place, or another TLU to talk about cows.
Okay. Commissioner Callison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the other strategies to deal with travel implications was to change the school siding requirements. I associate this with Barb. She was the one who really fought for this. This is probably a good example of the consensus process that Scott was talking about. The idea is that in statute, there has to be a certain amount of land acquired to build a new school. That forces the schools to be on the outskirts of towns, which means there's more driving back and forth. This was not one that I was particularly enamored of because it seemed to me it didn't have a big implication. It wasn't going to, changing those requirements wasn't going to change, have a big impact on greenhouse gases because we don't cite that many schools in Minnesota. But again, it was a consensus process. And so this stayed in, and I think Scott's point is well taken in terms of understanding how a consensus process works and what that means in terms of the final product. Another strategy, encourage walking and biking to school. Some suggestions here, including making it easier to rehabilitate older schools, reducing land requirements for new schools. That's what Barb was speaking or was arguing for, requiring bike pedestrian access from local neighborhoods, and then require bicycle parking. Improve street connectivity. That's again to make areas more walkable, less auto dependent, encourage other options for people to get around. And then this is one that Will had already spoken on, which is to retrofit roadway to improve access for all users. So, again, the idea that we use our streets to encourage other forms of transportation than by automobile. Street design, there's information in your report on that. Reform the zoning requirements. This probably gets me back into my plea that you not micromanage and that you recognize local authority in some of these areas and understand that oftentimes if you set goals, there's a lot of creativity and people will find the best way to get to that goal for their own community. And then, this also?
Yeah.
Well, you can,
yeah. Or I can.
You can take that.
Okay. All right. Let me emphasize, you know, most of this stuff is not new to Minnesota. Minnesota has been a leader on a lot of these policies throughout the years. And to the extent that when I travel, other people say, well, you sure have to be in Minnesota. You're all doing all the right stuff already. And, you know, I think it was part of our chart to decide whether, in fact, we were already doing all the right stuff. And so the Met Council has for many years done infrastructure targeting where, again, just to sort of oversimplify, they look for areas where locating or focusing growth in those areas it benefits us as a community in one way or another. I like to think about it as using growth to help us solve problems rather than to create problems. People like growth, but they're like, oh, more traffic, you know, more problems. But we have a lot of problems that growth can solve. There are a lot of places that are empty that can use redevelopment. So you identify places where growth helps us solve problems. And then you identify places where you would just assume growth did not go because it's fragile land. You want to keep it in farming because that's important to the state. Or it's just too expensive to serve for one reason or another with infrastructure. And then the Met Council, you know, sends sewer lines to the places that they want growth to go and they don't send it to places where they don't want growth to go. And it's been doing that for years. And the recommendation of the TWIG was just that process needs to be a little more aggressive, honestly, and add greenhouse gas emissions to the list of criteria that the Met Council applies to the decision about where it sends infrastructure. That process would be productively applied outstate as well. Again, when I travel, a number of times rural local electeds have come up to me and, you know, complained bitterly about the fact that, you know, locate a business or housing or a school, you know, far outside town, but then they have to provide all the infrastructure to get out to it and where are they going to find that money, et cetera. So I think that the consensus around our own group and then the MPAG generally was that these are ideas that can be productively, more intensively applied throughout Minnesota, and that as a result, people would save money, we would have more livable communities, and we would reduce greenhouse gas. Let me just wrap up here.
Well, I have a question.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was looking through the list of who was on this panel and some of the recommendations that we had, and I'm wondering, were there any engineers who gave insight into some of the recommendations we had specifically related to maybe we design streets this way because of safety reasons or other reasons? Were there any engineers who gave insight?
Mr. Schwartz.
Thank you very much. Our specific group did not have such engineers. I'm pretty familiar with, hold on, hasten to say that I'm not an engineer, I'm pretty familiar with most of that debate, and I know Barb is, and it was a former mayor, your conversant in that. So I think that we had input on those subjects, and the to come back to Mayor Callison's point, Commissioner Callison's point, the recommendations were not so restrictive. I mean, we're not saying narrow your roads to 10 feet lanes, right? Because that's beyond. We were saying there's a growing experience around the country and in many places in Minnesota where these new road designs have worked and worked well, and we're encouraging MnDOT and local jurisdictions to do road design to do more of that and less of the old way.
And Ms.
Thielman. Mr. Chair and Representative, you may remember that last year the legislature directed the Minnesota Department of Transportation to do a study of complete streets. I'll be serving on an advisory panel. There is an advisory committee as well. And so over the course of this year, the DOT, county and city engineers, members of the public health community, and others will be looking at this whole issue of now what they're calling complete streets or street retrofits. And they'll look at everything, I think, from speed limits to road design standards to funding and all those sorts of things. And I think they decided to do that, or you directed them to do that, in part because there has been this movement across the nation looking at streets as having more than just one function, and that there are other ways to improve safety beyond some of the standard practices that we've used today. And we've seen a number of states, Florida being one, Massachusetts being another, initially passing some sort of complete streets legislation and then coming back and really wholesale revising their road design standards, their manuals, their training, all those sorts of things. I don't know if that's where this process will lead, but certainly you've started all of us, city engineers, county engineers, and the DOT down the road of exploration.
Thank you, Ms. Thielman. And Mr. Schwartz.
Thank you very much.
I could just remind people real quick, too, about cell phones, and if you could shut those off, because there is a little interference in the audio here. So, thank you, Mr. Schwartz.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Just a couple more points in summary here. One of the themes which came up throughout the process, and which we have not yet mentioned today, and so I want to make sure that we do mention it, is Commissioner Callison said, first of all, it became a math problem, and so we tried to come up with attainable strategies that would produce the results that we had been charged with getting. There was pretty healthy debate, I think, at the level of our individual work group and then at the level of the MCAG about whether some of the policies were in fact doable. You could do them, and then would they get the results that we anticipated, that we projected that they would get? And by adopting the policies, I think that the answer is that the policies that we advanced to the governor and to you are, in the judgment of the MCAG, both implementable and would get the results that we project that they would get if aggressively implemented in the time frame that we need to get them. I would summarize this by saying that we know what we need to do. Almost everything that we have talked about in this package of recommendations has been done in one form or another someplace else, and I would say with the exception of the low carbon fuel standards. California is doing a low carbon fuel standard. They don't yet know how they will do it, and so I think that's a wild card. And so I would emphasize the doability of all the policies except for that one. I would also emphasize that because some of them are a little bit uncertain, particularly the low carbon fuel standard, which is, you know, 30% of our target, all the more reason to be aggressive on the others in case that one doesn't. To get that level of implementation, we need action at all levels of government, starting at the State House. Certainly, I think that the model for our recommendations is that the state would set policy direction. In some cases, it would roll to Department of Transportation, revise your road design standards. In other cases, it would roll to local government, revise your zoning regulations. But you do it, not the state, right? We hope. But the state must lead, and I think that that was the consensus and the form of the recommendations that were produced.
And Representative Hausman has a question.
And so, Mr. Chair, are you working with legislators to draft recommendations in bill form and move them through this legislative session? What makes that happen? What makes certain that this isn't a report that gets filed on a shelf?
Mr. Schwab.
Thank you, Representative Hausman. In fact, just last week I was testifying on the Senate side for the Sensible Communities Act sponsored by Senator Dibble. They are implementing or would like to implement through that bill a number of the recommendations under Group 1, the BMP. So that's one action that I know of. It sounds like the Complete Streets is being acted on. I'm not tracking everything else, but I know that the recommendations generally have the attention of legislators. You're giving them some attention today. So I guess two answers. I don't know that we're individually pushing them, and there was nothing built into the report to make it self-implementing. But I know that action is being taken.
And one of the reasons we're holding the hearing today is because we want some testimony and information before hearing bills that are going to deal with this. And we will be hearing, looking at a couple of bills that deal with both the land use issue and the low carbon fuel standards. So hopefully get things moving or get the ball rolling here. And Mr. Shore, you want to continue?
I'll wrap up here. Thank you, Senator, Representative Eakin. So we wrapped up last spring, and it's been a little while since then, and many things have changed, not least we have a big stimulus act now. And as I said at the very beginning of our discussion here today, when the MCAG agreed to a characterization of the costs and benefits here, that these would all these recommendations in our group would produce net benefits, they were not saying that there were not upfront costs. There will be upfront costs in a lot of this stuff. But that over time, those investments would pay returns in terms of lower fuel bills, time savings, shorter sewer lines, less road repair costs. That would more than pay for themselves. The question then is, well, where do you get the upfront investment money? And I think one of the, not that anyone is happy to see the meltdown or even the stimulus necessarily, but since we are having the stimulus money coming, a good chunk of it to Minnesota DOT, I think there is, without getting into any specifics here, potentially a way to fund some of that upfront investment that's required. As I mentioned, there was a lot of debate about whether our recommendations would produce the reductions that we forecast that they would. Central to that debate was, and I think was actually alluded to by Mark Vandershaft, is the question of how fast does land use change? And I want to be clear that this was not part of the discussion. Now I'm speaking for myself into the twig here, but I thought it might be interesting, as long as you were calling me to testify, to bring you this data. Although I can't say that twig members didn't look at it on their own. I don't remember being presented to the twig. But anyway, long before $4 a gallon gas, we were seeing a really substantial shift toward new residential construction in center cities. And for those of you who are not close to the screen, the uptick in these curves starts in 1999 And the really aggressive one here is Miami, with a 25% increase in downtown or central city share of new residential construction. Boston, Philadelphia, Washington, and Atlanta being the others. And these are not necessarily growing places. I mean, Greater Philadelphia is not a great, a booming place. And nonetheless, people are deciding to move from outside Philadelphia into center city Philadelphia. So I think that there is a market shift here. I think that it coincides with the DMT stats that Barb Selman talked about, where we're actually seeing a decrease in driving. Not a decrease in the increase, but a net decrease in driving. And I think that, you know, what exactly has changed is a very long discussion that we probably don't have time for before 6 o'clock. But I would submit to you that something has changed and that it will make implementing these recommendations not only easier, but that you will be not going against trends, but with them, and enabling them to occur in a way that I think is productive for the state, for your cities, for your constituents, and not least to the implementation of these goals. So I leave you with this. There are
how many new people coming to Minnesota for the next 20 years?
Mark will know.
Our forecast is a million new people between 2000 and 2030 in the seven county metropolitan area. Beyond that, I'm not, I think, maybe another 700,000.
Okay, so, yeah. So okay. More than 2 million new residents in Minnesota. I think that half of the development that will exist in 2050 will be built between now and 2050. So we have a lot of new stuff. We have new people and new stuff to work with. That is a community that is moving very fast. And the recommendations, if you will, from the MCAG are steer this way or steer that way. You've got a lot of momentum to work with. Steer it in the right direction.
Thank you, Mr. Schroeder.
Thank you very much for your time, and I know that we'll all be happy to take questions.
Thank you. Well, and Mr. Lambert, do you have anything else you wanted to
add? No, Mr. Chairman, I'm just happy to answer questions.
Okay. Any questions for the testifiers today?
So,
Representative Horstman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have some kind of big picture questions, and I can save those because I think that the Center for Transportation Studies gets into sort of the how many tons do we have to reduce and how do we add together enough policies to get those reductions. But we didn't really spend any time talking about the low-carbon fuel standard, and I know there's another member, the Twig, here that did work on this, and I didn't know if you wanted Mr. Grant to say a few words about that since it did account for 35% of the reductions.
Mr. Grant, did you want to say a few words on that? Welcome to the committee, Mr. Grant.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just Bill Grant for the Isaac Walton League. And to be clear, I was not on the Transportation and Land Use Technical Working Group. I was on the full MCAG and a member of the Energy Supply Work Group. We didn't cover the low-carbon fuel standard in the depth today. I don't know if you want to go into that. I think that the points I'd like to make about it are that it is a policy that is being considered in a number of states now, in New England, in California, and a number of Midwestern states as well. And there's a regional effort ongoing now to evaluate a low-carbon fuel policy. There is a bill that's been introduced. Representative Portman has a bill. But in general, the concept is to reduce carbon intensity from transportation fuels by a certain amount over a period of years, and it's a gradual reduction. And the point of the initiative is to really, for a state like Minnesota, to drive innovation in the biofuel sector and really reduce carbon intensity from the ethanol and biodiesel production that we already have ongoing. Minnesota has a great advantage in this regard because with the ethanol and biodiesel mandates that we already have in place, we have some of the most progressive ethanol and biodiesel producers in the country. Many of them are innovating now to reduce their energy use from the process perspective, and are going to be looking at alternative feedstocks, which can also reduce carbon emissions over time. This is a real opportunity for a state like Minnesota, and given that there's a great deal of work being done on this now nationally, but primarily on both coasts, we think it's important that Minnesota look aggressively at this policy as well from the perspective of a renewable fuel producer. So I'd be happy to take any questions that you have about the details of a policy like this, but I did think that the group didn't cover this in sufficient detail, primarily because the members of the Transportation Land Use Group were focused, I think, on land use related issues, and that's understandable.
And just as a reminder, the low carbon fuel standard was one of those options that was unanimously selected by the MCAG, along with the land use, which is also unanimous. Any questions on the low carbon fuel standard? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, Mr. Chair, I had a general question for the group. I want to thank you for your presentation today. It seems that really, as I look through these, all of them are reducing the freedoms of Minnesotans either through higher taxes or mandates. Are there any in here that are not?
Thank you, Representative. Will Thrower, attempting to characterize the recommendations. I think that I would reply in two ways. The first is that we mentioned earlier, and I would broaden the point to suggest that a lot of these are about giving folks more choice, actually. Today, there is actually a very small pilot program that allows you through Progressive Insurance to buy pay-as-you-drive insurance. But if you, in fact, have a need for a second car, but you only want to drive it for various reasons once a month, there's no good way to get insurance for that car that recognizes that you only take it out once a month. You have to buy a blanket coverage. And this is probably heresy, but I would probably buy something. I would probably buy another car and get that coverage for it. But anyway, but we don't do that today because it's just too expensive to insure that car. The treatment of complete streets is all about giving folks more choices about how to get around. There are, to my mind anyway, a remarkable number of places in Minnesota where to get from point A to point B, you must drive. Mm-hmm. And to drive, you must have a car. And to have a car, you must have insurance for the car, et cetera. And so I think that broadening the choices to allow you to get around in a way other than that way is actually a pretty fundamental expansion in freedom for a lot of people. I mentioned that I testified last week, and just so this isn't just my view that I'm bringing you, but I testified last week on the Senate side, and one of my the folks that I testified with was a young woman who attends Augsburg, who's from Bemidji. And she shared with the committee, so she took a job in Bemidji to raise money to go to school. The job was 20 minutes away, which isn't particularly far, I think, in Bemidji. But really the only way to get there was to drive. So she had to buy a car, and she had to insure the car. And after a month of working, she realized that she was moving. She was net behind. After she paid for the car and the gas and insurance, she had less savings than she had when she had started her job that she had taken purely to save money for college. And again, this isn't me. I'm just repeating her testimony to the committee, which was a little more focused on land use. And she said, "Mark my words, I'm never going to live someplace again where I am trapped like that because I have no choice. I had to come up with this money, and I have no way to do it. And now that I live in the cities, if I need to get a job, I can walk to it, I can bicycle to it, I can take the bus to it, or I can buy a car." And she was pretty emphatic on the point. So I would suggest to her view that her view is, at least, that these recommendations would improve her freedom.
Okay, and we just have two more questions, and then we need to move on to the next testifier. So, Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, there's more comments. I've been trying to figure out how to constructively state my frustration with listening to this presentation. as a representative of Greater Minnesota that has a lot of farmers, and listening to vehicle miles traveled and trying to figure out how do we consolidate those farms into a community where the kids can bike to school. And certainly I know you're not saying you can do that, but I hope you'll understand that. I hope to hear constructively from this group, maybe as this process moves forward or as legislation moves forward, and understanding that we can't consolidate the farms, or you can, but in ways that may not be helpful. And I know that maybe Representative Torkelson and Ertl both looking at me and thinking maybe some of the same things about these land use and other ideas, and yet when freight rail comes up, for example, something that actually might be helpful for reducing, if it were, it's kind of giving short shrift. Well, we couldn't really get to that. I know maybe it's lateness in the hour, and I apologize for my tone, but if I don't know what message I take back to Greater Minnesota, especially not the inter or the regional center of Greater Minnesota, and ask them to read this.
Okay. And I think Ms. Spellman wanted to respond quickly.
Mr. Chair, and members, I mean, I think there were more potentially of us on the group that were Metro as opposed to Greater Minnesota, but I think a number of the things that we talked about and described in this report are things that can apply to Greater Minnesota. Certainly, targeting our infrastructure investments in a way that makes it easier for people to get around or make development more likely in town as opposed to on the edge of town is one of those things. And I just think of myself as a resident of Winona and how at one time so much of our jobs and our shopping was downtown. And then all of a sudden the development all went out to Highway 61. And so then our school went way out of town. And so now nobody could anymore safely walk to school. It was very difficult to walk to the shopping out on the bypass, out on the highway, and some of our infrastructure in town really deteriorated. And I thought, and I think that's true in all of our cities, you know, are we targeting our infrastructure investments to rebuild what we already have? I mean, no business wants to expand on a corridor where the sidewalks are falling apart, the road is falling apart, the streetlights are rusted. So are we rebuilding those places that we already have made a significant infrastructure investment in lighting, in utilities, in all those kinds of things, or are we continuing to build out here where we have to serve them with all this new infrastructure? I think that is a really important recommendation that is in this report, and one that has been taken very seriously across the country as communities try to grapple with the budget challenges that they're facing.
Okay, thanks. Thank you, Ms. Thoman. And Representative Hortman, did you have want to respond to this point?
Just on the issue of freight, because I was a little frustrated. I felt that the stakeholder group that was appointed by the governor underrepresented rail. There was one short line railroad represented, but there was a substantial representation on the trucking side of the equation. And I think sometimes, you know, the people that you put in a room to come up with solutions influence the solutions that come out of the room.
Okay. And Representative Hornstein has a statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, thank you, Chair Eakin, for convening us and including the Transportation Committee. Just a very quick comment before we move on to the Center for Transportation study, which is important, and I want to get to that. But as the author of that Building Sensible Communities Act, I want to let the members know that this is not just good for the environment. This is really good for our pocketbooks. And one thing that we didn't talk about today, which I hope we will more in the hearings as it still moves through, is that we're saving, through this plan, incredible amounts of money on public infrastructure. To build new highways now and to build wastewater treatment facilities and sewer interceptors is incredibly expensive public infrastructure. So this is both cheaper and better for the environment, and I think that's why we call it Sensible Communities, because as we try to accommodate these 2 million people moving to the state, we're going to have to really target very strategically our infrastructure investments. So this is really about both the economy and the environment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. And we're going to move on. Next, we have the Center for Transportation Studies report. And I want to step forward, please. Thank you, Mr. Schwer. And thank you for all those who testified today. Thank you. Thank you, and Ms. McGinnis?
That's correct.
Okay, if you'd like to begin.
I would, and thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Lori McGinnis. I am Associate Director at the Center for Transportation Studies at the University of Minnesota. We're very pleased to be here today. We always appreciate the opportunity to serve as a resource to the legislature. You know, we consider it an important role of the university to bring facts and information that help inform you as you move through your processes and policy making. And so that's what we're here for today, is to deliver information and facts about a study that we performed on behalf of the legislature last spring. We're not here advocating for any specific strategy that you've been hearing about or that you will hear about now. We are, again, just we're bringing facts and hopefully informing you as you move forward in your role. You each have a copy of the report, and we'll be drawing information from this summary report, which you were provided in your advance information, I believe. And certainly, if you have additional questions after you leave, please feel free to call us, either my colleague here or myself. We also have a website provided where quite a bit of additional information is provided, including more details about the final report, the full research report. So, about a year ago, I'm forgetting now, it was in 2007 actually, that Representative Hornstein and Representative Portman co-authored some legislation that asked the university to take a look at evaluating strategies that can be implemented to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector. So our scope was not as broad as the MPEG scope. We were looking at the transportation sector. We were looking at whether or not we can achieve, the state of Minnesota can achieve those goals set out by the Next Generation Energy Act. Our study was complementary to MPEG. It was happening in parallel with them. So we took great effort to stay in touch with what they were doing, connecting at the appropriate points. But important distinction is that our process, our study was not stakeholder driven. We were really looking at the world of what if, which is a great strength of an academic institution, is imagining possibilities and looking at the what if. And we could do that through the lens of science, engineering, technology, policy, all of those things. What we do at CTS is convene and bring together multidisciplinary teams, and the University of Minnesota has great strength in that area. We actually work with over 25 departments at the center, at the university. And for this study, we brought together investigators from mechanical engineering, civil engineering, and Humphrey Institute of Public Affairs. With me today is Dr. Julian Marshall, the principal investigator representing civil engineering. Regrettably, Dr. David Kittleson and Dr. Elizabeth Wilson were not able to be here with us today. They are out of town on travel. But we will do our humble best to represent their expertise, and if we're not able to answer questions, we'll make sure we follow up with you. As you can see here, and I always enjoy talking about this part of working at the university, another part of our mission is not only to bring you facts and information, but to educate tomorrow's practitioners. So there are a number of graduate students involved in this study, and we couldn't be prouder of the work they've accomplished and what they'll do to, as they move forward in their careers to advance this information. It's important, again, to just thank and acknowledge the fact that the Minnesota Legislature funded this study. Thanks again to Representative Portman and Frank Hornstein for their support. And we had a number of reviewers. So although we were in a stakeholder-driven process, we did involve a number of academic experts and a number of peers from around the country, some national experts. So we had local and national experts that we tapped into to help give us good guidance and good feedback, tough feedback sometimes, that helps guide our report. In addition, we, as I mentioned, tried to stay in touch with what the MPEG group was doing, and we are very grateful to the technical assistance we received from several agencies. Peter Zabrowski and others at MPCA, Frank Passo and his colleagues at MnDOT, and Dan Holman and others at Metro Transit. So, just to recap, our purpose, our mission here was looking at strategies for reducing greenhouse gas emissions and in conformance with the 2007 Minnesota Next Generation Energy Act. And you've already seen the goals, the 15%, 30%, 80%, so I won't spend any more time on that. But just to reiterate, we were looking at the transportation sector and assuming that our reduction target should be proportional to transportation share, which we estimated about 24%. I think I heard our previous presenters mention about 25%. So at this point, I'd like to hand off to Dr. Marshall, and he will walk through the technical portion of the presentation.
Welcome, Dr. Marshall. If you could state your name for the record, please.
Sure, thank you. Julian Marshall. I'm an assistant professor of environmental engineering at the University of Minnesota. So, yeah, I will take it from there and just reiterate that our analysis was, again, not to advocate for any particular policy option, but to pose what-if questions and see how different options would play out in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. So that, therefore, becomes a mathematical or a modeling question. How will emissions change going forward into the future if certain things happen or don't happen? Here's the guts of our model, the general equation that we're using. So we're trying to track emissions over time, and that requires looking at three terms. The first one reflects the vehicles that people choose to drive, and that's represented in the fuel consumption here in gallons per mile, or that's 1 over miles per gallon, which we're commonly think of in comparing among vehicles. So that's the vehicle component. The second component is fuels, what fuels are used in those vehicles, and we track that in terms of the carbon content, so the amount of carbon as a shorthand for CO2 per gallon of fuel. And then the third portion is the activity level, the transportation activity in vehicle miles traveled. So those are the three aspects of this issue that we're going to track going forward over time. I'll lead with our conclusions, our study findings. The first is that the transportation sector can achieve its target. However, to do so will require the following two things. The first is that meeting the goal requires all three approaches. That is, addressing the three terms I just showed on the previous slide, vehicle fuel efficiency, secondly, the carbon content of fuel, and thirdly, the land use and system shift as represented by the distance people travel, vehicle miles traveled. It's common, I found, for people to advocate for one or two of these three, and one of the core findings was that we really need to address all three of these issues if we are going to meet the goals as passed by the Next Generation Energy Act. And then the second core finding there is we must start now. When we're looking at how projections of emissions going out into the future, when we look at scenarios where we delay action, that made it impossible really to meet the goals that were set out in that act. So with that, I'm going to step through each of those three issues that I mentioned. Now, I'm not going to spend much time on vehicle efficiency because, as you've heard, that's not the focus of today's meeting. And so, actually, I think we'll just move right on, seeing that time is short, and I'll make a couple comments on fuel carbon content. So again, this is the amount of carbon per gallon of fuel, and one of the main points illustrated in this slide is it's important to look at the whole fuel life cycle. The illustrations up there on the right-hand side of the screen is the actual use of that fuel when it's combusted in a vehicle engine. But when considering the overall greenhouse gas emissions from producing that fuel, it's important to consider not only the combustion in the engine, but also the life cycle producing that fuel, all the energy that goes into the processes to deliver the fuel to the vehicle. And we have those listed up there, starting from resource extraction and then refining those materials and distributing them to where people can consume and use them. This chart represents the life cycle emissions from a number of different fuels. The text may be too small to see from where you're sitting, so I'll mention that the first bar on the left, it represents petroleum, conventional gasoline, and that's compared against several other fuels. The main point of this slide is that there's a significant variability in the height of those bars. That is, that when we look at different fuels that either are available or that might be available, there are significant differences in the overall life cycle greenhouse gas emissions from those fuels. I'll call your attention to the fourth bar, which represents E85, that is a mixture of fourth from the left, representing 85% ethanol and the remainder gasoline. There's quite a bit of controversy and investigation as to what would be the life cycle emissions from that type of fuel. Some people say that it's greater than gasoline. Some people say the reverse. I think most people, however, would agree that it's comparable to gasoline. And what's far more important is that what we're looking to are next generation biofuels to really deliver the deep cut in greenhouse gas emissions that would be needed to achieve the goals as passed by the Next Generation Energy Act. There's a few bars there focusing on electric vehicles and pointing out that if we're thinking about plug-in hybrid electric vehicles, the source of the electricity energy which you're plugging into that electric grid matters significantly in what would be the emissions from that type of vehicle. Then let me move on to the vehicle miles traveled or the land use component of this. This is a chart that shows the first that the solid line on the left is historic vehicle miles traveled, and you can see that it's been increasing over time until recently when it leveled off. And Frank Passo just mentioned to me that the current indication is that in 2008 the total vehicle miles traveled in our state actually dropped about 3% or so. So we in our modeling in the scenarios we were looking at, we posed three what-if questions, and those are the three lines there for what may happen to vehicle miles traveled going out into the future. There's the lowest line there, the black line, saying what if vehicle miles traveled stays level, does not increase, and then increases more slowly, the second line, the blue line, or increases more rapidly, the third line, the red line. When we plug these three possible futures into our model, the outcome, the projections for greenhouse gas emissions look something like this. These are three lines corresponding to the same three assumptions going into the model. And what you can see is that there's a significant difference among those three lines. That is, what happens to vehicle miles traveled will have a significant impact on the greenhouse gas emissions going forward in our state. Now, these three lines, as I mentioned, include already significant reductions from improvements in technologies and vehicles, and also include a low carbon fuel standard. So for all three of these lines, we're already addressing vehicles and fuels, and we're looking at the third component of land use and vehicle miles traveled. And I guess I'll mention one last thing there, which is that the highest line, which includes vehicles and fuels, does not meet those objectives. It's only when we do those two things and also include the third comment, vehicle miles traveled, that we also see the reductions that meet the targets set up by the Next Generation Energy Act. Again, we're not here to advocate for any specific policies. We thought it might be useful to mention some of the policies that people tend to discuss when thinking about vehicle miles traveled, and you already heard a lot about those, so I won't spend much time on that, but just to mention that there are several policies out there that people think about when thinking about land use and vehicle miles traveled. So I'll just close by mentioning that we looked at a number of different scenarios. That was the point of the study, was again to pose several what-if questions and to see would it be possible to meet the objectives set out in the Next Generation Energy Act within the transportation sector. And what we found, and I'll close this by repeating those conclusions, is twofold. One is that to meet those objectives, it's necessary to address all three issues, to include all three approaches: shift in vehicles, shift in fuels, and also shift in land use, system change / vehicle miles traveled. We have to do all three. We really can't count on just one or two to get us where the target suggests we need to go. And again, the second thing is we really need to start now to get to meet those goals. So thank you, and we're happy to take questions.
Okay, thank you, Doctor. Any questions for the testifiers? Okay, Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. When you talk about the life print of a different type of fuel, how do you account for the differences of a fossil fuel coming from Canada or Saudi Arabia, for example?
I mean, I would just say it's an excellent question. The short answer is it's important to account for that. So the life cycle analysis attempts to do just that, to look at the energy needs all along the process, whether we're talking about a biofuel or conventional petroleum fuel, which comes from outside the U.S. and needs to be shipped here, or electricity as a potential fuel. I mean, we don't have plug-in vehicles right now. There's the Chevrolet Volt that I see ads for that may come out. But it's important to include all of those energy inputs if we want to look at the true total impact from the different fuels.
And how,
Mr. Chair, may I add to that?
Oh, sure, Ms. McGinnis.
Thank you. My eyesight, I have to get a little further away here to see, but as I recall, the different bars, and help me out, Joanne, if you can see it, but they did take into account when something comes from Canada, as I understand it, it's more from the tar sands, and that has a different, that's certainly going to be different on one side of that equation. So our analysis does account for those types of differences when a particular type of oil or coal comes from a different part of the world.
Thank you, Mr. Ganner. And Representative Sunstein.
Thank you. And it's a question for either of you. I'm glad that you pointed out that, you know, we have the advantage of electric vehicles is significantly higher when it's from renewables, and we're moving in that direction. But on the slide where you mentioned the impact of coal, negating some of the advantages of electrification, did you factor in the off-peak production? It's my understanding that when people are plugging in at night, some of those emissions are already out there anyway, and so we're just making these plants a little more efficient with that nighttime usage. Was that part of the calculation that you mentioned?
That's a great question. People are in many different scenarios for when would electric vehicles be plugged in. Of course, we don't have electric vehicles to plug in right now. These bars that you're seeing right here are if electricity is derived from source X or source Y. So we would just say that what the source is matters. And if it turns out to be the case that the additional energy needed to recharge vehicles comes at night from one source or the other, and then that will have a significant impact.
Thank
you. So yes, we certainly include that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. And Representative Fortin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is an exceptionally good slide and explains why I'm carrying the low carbon fuel standard. If you look at the, you know, this is just for members because I don't have this chart to hand to you about my bill, but I should get a copy of it. It just really shows the significance of what we can do in Minnesota with biofuels. We've been a nationwide leader, whether it's on E10 or E20, and this shows really how we can lead the nation with a low carbon fuel standard that really puts us in a completely different place with regard to the carbon that's coming, that we're putting into our cars to power them. So I just would ask you to keep an open mind on the concept of a low carbon fuel standard, because I think it's so important that we develop a Midwestern model that works for our particular expertise in biofuels.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Chair Eakin. I'm going to take the opportunity to turn to page 9, if I might. Let's look into the future or the present. I'm not sure which is this chart, but members, the same old song, I suppose. On the far right, heavy rail, maximum capacity. And I was wondering if you could mention for a moment the importance or the potential for heavy rail.
The importance of shifting.
Right.
Yeah, so just to explain this chart, this is on page 9. Thank you for reading your report. That's great. I appreciate that. And figure 5, there are two lines for each mode there. To derive the lighter line, which ends up being higher in each case, the lighter blue, that's when we look at the emissions per passenger mile at actual loads, because all these modes tend to have empty seats. The darker blue line, the shorter line, is at maximum capacity. What if we filled all of those seats with people? What's the optimal, that is the lowest emissions that it could possibly be? And I think this point is well taken, that there's a significant difference between the light blue and dark blue lines in each case, and especially in heavy rail, there's a significant difference there. I guess one thing that suggests on the policy side is that one way to reduce emissions in general and from rail specifically would be greater utilization of our already existing facilities.
That's a good point. Thank you, Dr. Marshall. And Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think my disappointment in both of the reports that we've heard tonight is how transit and rail were discussed. On this one, I went through as nearly as I could and turned over pages where I saw even the mention of transit and rail, and in this, you know, significant amount of work, it really wasn't very much. And this one, in some ways, is even more confusing, because I don't see how it makes any, what the point would be of measuring any one mode, because if we do this right, we do everything. We do all public mass transit all over the state. We do intercity rail, regional rail, rail to Chicago, etc. We do it all, and cumulatively, each surely has even a greater effect. So that idea of measuring each mode, I don't even think in that way anymore, because all the maps show how they all work together. And at some point, I just, of course, have been disappointed that environmental and energy groups haven't caught the vision of that and moving, helping us move much more aggressively in that direction as an alternative, including the Little Cross. I think that's it. For the kinds of arguments I make, I don't get a lot of help from these two reports yet in terms of statistics that I can make my arguments with.
Chair Hornstein.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hausman, because there are a number of reports that have said that transit is clearly the single most important mode for reducing greenhouse gases and saving oil that we can do in terms of any of these strategies. But several studies have shown that, and I think it's really important that we keep focused on that. In terms of a mode shift, that's the way to go. That's when Congressman Oberstar was here a few weeks ago, I think he reiterated that, and it is something to keep our eye on.
Mr. Chair, any other questions? Ms. McGinnis.
Just to address Representative Hausman, we appreciate your feedback on that, and we certainly be willing to do more or to dive deeper in any particular area to the extent we have the time and scope of this project. We were able to produce this level of information, but we always stand ready to go further.
Thank you, Ms. McGinnis. Any further questions for our testifiers? Okay. Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony today. Very interesting. So, thank you. Meeting is adjourned.